Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
Hello and welcome to The Tennis Show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Abigail Johnson, who is a tennis journalist, and Anna Smith, who is a professional tennis player. We're looking back on a fantastic week of play at the French Open, starting us off Konta. What a performance, what a result.
Yeah, absolutely. Konta has been bringing her clay court form of the season to date into Roland Garros. And she was emphatic, I think, in that most recent win over Sloane Stephens in the quarterfinals, 6-1, 6-4. And I'm not sure about you guys, but I think a lot of people were kind of picking Stephens to come through that because she was a finalist last year, because, you know, she's good on the surface. She's asserted herself here before. And Konta, obviously, more of a new face on the scene when it comes to clay court success. I mean, personally, I thought that Konta definitely had big shots there because of all the pressure that was on Stephen's shoulders, having made the final last year, points to defend and that kind of thing. But she really did impress and came out with a clean game, clear game plan, I thought. What do you think, Anna?
Well, I thought she played flawless tennis. But also, I think we have to look back at Rome. She beat Sloane, so she's had that confidence. She knows she can beat her. But I mean, I think it was just, I don't think she could have done anything better. The first serve percentage was incredible. First serve points won was, I think she won 22 out of 23 in the second set, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, you know, if she can keep it up, I'd probably say she's for the title.
Yeah, I mean, she was bringing out that 1-2 punch a lot and keeping those points short and conserving energy at the end of the day. How much do you think that will help her going into her next round and potentially the round after? Because obviously she's now the heavy favourite, really, to come through that semi-final.
Yeah, I mean, I think she is probably the favourite. But at the same time, I think she's still had that taking it match by match, which I think has worked well for her this whole clay court season. And if she can keep serving the way she has and just taking it point by point, I think, you know, next round she has a great chance.
Yeah. What's interesting to me about the next round is it's kind of a turning of the tables for Konta, because so far, I mean, in her last match, let's put it this way, Stephens was the finalist last year. Stephens, while she'd lost her previous two meetings with Konta, was looking decent at this tournament and on this surface. And then Konta goes into her next match against a player who I don't think had made a Grand Slam quarterfinal before this tournament. And she's a lot younger. She's not seeded. But at the same time, incredibly talented. I think a
lefty
lot of people
as well.
Yeah, lefty,
which he hasn't played, so
yeah,
that could be an issue.
Yeah, and they can bring, you know, the spin serve out wide, and there's just a lot of tricks that you know a lefty can bring to the court that a righty would like to have in their pocket. And the thing with Vondrousova is she's coming in just less on the radar than Konta, and with almost more able to relax and more able to swing a bit, I think, than Konta, who's now gone from the situation of everything to gain to now being the player that I guess a lot of people are expecting to come through. I mean, you know Konta fairly well. You've played Fed Cup with Konta. What do you think of her mental state and how she would deal with an occasion like this?
I think she'll be completely fine. I think we've seen, I think she's in a few other slams, she's made semifinals as well. And I don't think it'll be an issue for her. I think, you know, she has that inner belief that she can win. She can just focus on what she needs to do. I think Vondrousova will be different because she's a lefty, like I said. And then she's got a lot more variety in her game and sort of than someone like Sloane does. So she's got the potential to mix up a little bit more. And obviously that lefty going into the backhand and then the drop shots that she does. I think it's going to be tricky. But I think if she gets the serve working well, if she can get that first strike in, I think she does stand a chance. But, you know, I think it'll be tough.
Yeah. I mean, Konta, it can't be stressed enough how well she's done, I think, to come from Rome and play so well, fall short of the final hurdle, but still continue that form into this tournament. I mean, we saw Karolina Pliskova, who won in Rome, going out early against a player who likes to change it up, who was asking her questions. Konta, I mean, how much do you think she thought about it coming into the French and thought about the opportunity and the way she was playing?
I honestly don't think she would have thought about it that much. I think the first thing she would have thought about is just take it round by round. Just don't think about anything, you know, going deep in the second week. I think it'd just be match by match, point by point, because that's the way that she's thought always and the way that's been successful for her. So I don't think she would change anything in that respect. Mm. But, you know, I think, yeah, like I said, the first thing she would want to get over that first hurdle. And then once she's done that, her confidence has increased. And then, you know, she's been able to kind of step on the gas a little bit more round by round.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? I mean, Conta's got a new coach that obviously has had for a while. What kind of impact do you think that the coaching relationship has on a player? Is it when a player starts to get good results, how much of an impact do you think the coach has?
Well, I think for me, Dimitri has had quite a big impact because I got to see her in pre-season when I was doing my rehab as well. And they specifically worked a lot on skills. So I think that's a lot where the drop shots have come from.
Okay.
So initially, I think maybe she's a little bit like cautious in doing that because I guess she's, you know, a big hitter. She wants to hit big from the back of the court and not having to mix up the drop shots, the slice or anything. But I think it's added an extra dimension to her game. And I think we're seeing it now, you know, with how successful the drop shots have been, especially over the clay court season. And I think he's also kind of tried to teach her to take a little bit of ownership as well and not kind of rely on the coach so much. And I think it's really showing now.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention about the variety in a game. I think that's so important when it comes to clay, longer points. You have to, I guess, have a few more options in your bag. And we're seeing a more developed Johanna Konta now than we have done in the previous seasons. How much of an impact do you think that's had? But most of all, how good do you think Konta is compared to the Konta we were seeing on clay maybe a couple of seasons ago? Because she's getting good results. She could have had a tougher draw, potentially, at the French Open. She's handled what she's got. Where would you rate her in comparison to, say, a couple of seasons ago on the surface?
I wouldn't say that much has changed. I think she's always had the confidence that she can play well on clay. I honestly just think it's just having had match wins that makes such a massive difference. And beforehand, she hadn't had those match wins in a row, whereas now, going into the clay court season, she's had a lot of matches and won, I think it's about 15 matches this season. So, you know, I think that's probably the biggest difference. And now she's really showing that she can win on this surface.
Yeah, I mean, she's been winning tremendously. But we obviously, Konta, as you say, not looking ahead. We're looking ahead a bit because two of the quarterfinals still haven't been played due to rain. We've got Madison Keys versus Simona Halep, Ashleigh Barty, and a second one as well. One of those four players still in, Simona Halep, Amanda Anisimova is the other one. One of those four players could potentially be up against Konta in the final. Now, do you think the fact that they will be having to play more matches closer together because of the rain is going to negatively impact them if they potentially come up against a fresh Johanna Konta?
I think once you reach a quarters of a slam, you kind of find a way to dig deep. You know, I think if Halep plays 2-7-6 in the third, I still think that she's going to be able to run all day for that final. So I don't think it's going to have a massive difference. But again, it could play a little bit of a part, but I don't think once you reach the final of a slam, you're thinking about fatigue at all.
No. One player that really hasn't been experiencing fatigue is Simona Halep. She's played a couple of three-set matches, but still looks pretty strong. She thrashed Iga Swiatek recently, a promising rising teenager. She has Amanda Anisimova next, who is a much-talked-about 17-year-old. Let's talk a little bit about Halep. What do you think her chances are of defending the title? Because defending on the women's circuit isn't something that we see a lot of at majors at the moment.
I think she does stand a good chance. I mean, you know, she's going to leave everything on the court. And she's one of those players that is hard to hit off the court because she kind of stands so far back and just will make loads of balls. So I think that could be a tricky thing for Jo, especially if, you know, she's not hitting the ball as well as she could. But at the same time, I'd probably say that she's maybe likely to make the final.
Wow.
She's my prediction anyway.
Making predictions is a great thing.
In terms of Konta's form, this tournament hasn't traditionally been a massively happy hunting ground for her. It all seems to be clicking into place this year. Can she go all the way?
Yes. I'm putting it out there. Yes, she can.
Straight up there.
Will she?
Oh, God.
They're two very different questions, aren't they? Because can she? Absolutely. I think she's proven herself across the entire clay court season. Will she? Then you have to take other players' competitiveness, their ability into consideration. And there are still some real threats, even outside of Simona Halep on that other half of the draw. Ashleigh Barty, so much variety. And we were saying this before, me and Anna, so level-headed and down-to-earth and just gets on with her game. She's so focused. won Miami, obviously, before coming to clay and is still playing well on the surface. Madison Keys, Grand Slam finalist, who hits big, and when she's been landing her mark, she's been a force to be reckoned with this tournament. So, and then Anisimova, you know, she's young, but she can generate some real firepower and absorb the pace that's coming back at her. So any of those four would be no easy task for Konta, and you really have to. It's not just about how great Konta is at the moment, because I think we can all agree she's doing terrifically well, but it's about what she's up against too.
There are massive names in there. The likes of Halep, of course, is attempting to defend her title. But even if Konta isn't the favourite in there, will those stars be looking at her form on clay, and thinking, well, hang on a minute, I don't fancy her?
Well, I think if you look at the way she played against Sloane, I don't think anyone would want to play against her. I didn't see any flaws in her game. If she can keep that up, I genuinely don't see how anyone can beat her.
And it's about that aggression as well.
But it was controlled aggression as well. It wasn't reckless. It was very much within her comfort zone as well. And it was just so focused and so relentless.
Absolutely.
That I think, you know, if someone plays against that, then I just don't see how they can hurt her.
Wonderful stuff. Could we have a British winner at the French Open? It would be quite something. And talking of British tennis players, one could be set to make a comeback. Andy Murray could be playing a bit of doubles before the summer is up.
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to The Tennis Show on Love Sport Radio with me, Johnny Burrow, and Abigail Johnson and Anna Smith. And Andy Murray, he's back. Or is he? We're hearing that he's planning to return for the doubles at Queen's Club later this month. Wimbledon, of course, probably a bridge too far. Are you excited to see him return to the court?
Yeah, definitely. As a Brit, you know, you want to see probably the greatest player we've ever had back in the game. I feel like we need to sort of like dampen expectations a little bit and just kind of see what happens. But obviously, I'm glad to see him back on the court. You obviously saw in Australia how emotional he was about everything and the potential that he might never play again. So I think for him to come back is great. But let's just kind of give him a little bit of a chance to come back and see how it goes.
I mean, speaking about dampening expectations, he did a pretty decent job of that himself, Murray, I guess, with that press conference in Australia where a lot of people thought, hey, he might be on his way out, just because he was so dismayed and distressed. And I mean, he was close to tears of not crying. I think they had to break up that press conference midway through. And
is that because Serena Williams wanted to come in?
Well, we may never know, but no. I think Murray, for all the accusations he gets about having a lack of character and being a boring person, he does get very emotional. And I think that's why, personally, I felt there was this rush to send him into retirement. Murray, I always say this, Murray never said the word retire. He never said he was going to retire. He might have indicated strongly that he thought he was coming near the end, but he never said I'm on his way out. The montage when he was on court.
I mean, he did say he was going to stop. So that's kind of a little bit.
But did he say retire?
Okay, no, he didn't say the word specifically retire.
Here's the thing. I mean, because when you're in that position, I mean, he was obviously so depressed with the situation. You're obviously going to feel more pessimistic in that moment. And I think it was obvious to everyone watching that he really wasn't in the greatest state of mind, really, for assessing his long-term future. It was a bit of a bad time to make such an announcement, I guess, because then everybody ran with it, as they will, of course. The press need their clicks and money in their pocket. We all need to live, right?
they know how to get them as well. Of course, Anna, you are a long way away from retirement, luckily, but you have some experience of struggling with injury as well. That's part of where that emotion is coming from. How hard is it to be out for an extended spell and then try and get back to your best?
Yeah, it's obviously probably one of the hardest things as an athlete you have to go through. Unfortunately, I guess I've had my fair share of injuries over my career. And obviously I'm currently rehabbing as well. So I know what he feels like, but I also know that it is different if you have an injury just when you're playing your sport. But then at the same time, he obviously couldn't do things on a day-to-day basis, as, you know, play with his kids or, you know, whatever it may be. And I think that it gets to a point where you kind of become so depressed with not being able to do day-to-day things that a 31-year-old should be able to do. So you can understand his frustration, his emotion. I felt the same. You know, I struggle to walk up and down the stairs with my knees. So I know what he's feeling. And you can see in his press conference in Australia, all that kind of emotion just spill out. There's something he's dedicated his whole life to might be taken away from him, not because he wanted to stop, but because his body let him down. So
is there a feeling of injustice when that happens?
I suppose there is, but at the same time, you know, he has had an amazing career, so he can look back and be proud of everything that he's achieved. But as an athlete, you want to be able to go out on your own terms. You don't want your body to let you down, and that's probably the hardest thing to take. And if there's a chance that he come back, then he was obviously always going to try and do whatever he could to get back. And I do hope that we get to see him on court again and he can retire on his own terms.
Yeah, 100%. I think the big thing with Murray and the hip was, at the time, this is partly why he was so upset, it was only the hip. He said the rest of his body he felt could be playing for a few more years, and it was just that one part.
That's
that
a
was...
very major part.
I know.
I've broken a hip. And if it wasn't playing tennis, I hasten to add, but I can exclusively confirm that if your hip is shot, it can be the only part of you that is shot, but the rest of you isn't good for much either.
Yeah, uh-huh. It makes it a bit tricky to play tennis.
Definitely. But now there's no pain there. I mean, why shouldn't he come back at the end of the day? I mean, obviously, this surgery was supposed to improve his quality of life as opposed to get him back on the tennis court, but he's coming back to doubles, and we've seen Mike Bryan, it was that had the surgery last year, coming back doing well in doubles with his brother, and who's to say it can't be the same for Murray?
Could we see him even get back to singles in due course?
I mean, I'd be shocked if he doesn't give it a try. Mm-hmm. If the doubles is successful and he doesn't have any problems, then I would be shocked if he doesn't give singles a go. I think we need to kind of be a bit realistic as to what he can reach. But if anyone can do it, I think Andy can make it back. Maybe not top five again, but, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at least top 20.
Well, I'm hoping so, because longer term listeners will remember that Love Sport's very own Patrick Christie's, who co-hosts Drive Monday to Friday, made the very rash promise about 6 months ago that should Andy Murray ever win Wimbledon again, he will present a show completely naked. And it was pointed out earlier that Patrick didn't specify doubles, singles. So if the doubles comeback is on the cards, it would still be unlikely. But if that happens, it could be quite a lively summer at Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
It's the tennis show on Love Sport Radio with Johnny Burrow, Abigail Johnson and Anna Smith. And I'm delighted to say that we're joined on the line by Love Sport tennis correspondent Roz Sattar, who is out there in France. Good evening, Roz. Thank you for joining us. Has the rain spoilt your day a bit?
Hello, bonsoir, yes. Truly has. I'm sat very despondently in the bar feeling très, très désolé.
Yeah, Roz, a day of no play when we were expecting...
Thrilling.
Yeah, no less than four singles matches to be played. Now, we were talking a bit about this earlier. Two of the women's matches in the quarterfinals have not been completed. Johanna Konta already through to the semi-finals. Do you think this is going to put any of the players on the other half of the draw a disadvantage, whoever makes the final? Do you think they're going to be under some pressure now?
I would say under no more pressure than if they were at a tournament, to be honest with you. We had a similar situation at Wimbledon when the women's final was put back because the men's semi-finals hadn't been completed. And somebody asked that same question, and the answer was, well, we play every day on the tour, you know, towards the end if you go deep. So from that perspective, the actual act of having to play 3 days in a row, absolutely not. However, this is a Grand Slam, nerves, adrenaline. You know, I don't know that it's going to do Vondrousova and Konta any good either, because they'll have gotten into their rhythm of practicing and they wouldn't have been able to practice at all. So, you know, I don't think anybody's going to sort of suffer adversarially, but I also don't think it's ideal when it comes to something like a slam.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of unexpected occurrences, what with the weather. But we've had a few upsets before now. There are potential for more. But in your opinion, Roz, what have been the biggest upsets so far this tournament?
It's kind of difficult to say, really. I mean, I wouldn't have actually called Serena or Osaka a particular upset. But just because of who they are, it generated the most news. And obviously the situation with press room gate just exacerbated all of that. I think if I had to pick a biggest upset on the women's side, it would have to be Bertens pulling out with illness so suddenly.
Pulling out? Is that really an upset?
I can't think of anything else that's really, you know, in terms of a nailed on choice. I can't think of anybody else that really is a lack to the draw. I mean, that whole bottom section of the draw just imploded.
Yeah.
Really.
Well, I mean, so, that's fair enough. I, especially on the men's side, I've noticed the Seeds have been doing really well in terms of living up to where they're supposed to go in the tournament. That means there's still quite a few high-ranked players on the men's side anyway, still in the competition. So what do you think we can expect from the rest of Roland Garros?
Oh, right. Well, obviously we have the hype that is going to be going absolutely giddy about Fedal episode 39. I can't wait for those notes to hit my in-basket. Hurrah. I'm more interested in seeing what Zverev turns up to play Djokovic, to be absolutely honest with you. He's been doing a very good impersonation of a duck with water flowing off his back, trying to laugh off all the concern about his five-setishness. You know, we saw last year that a plethora of five sets didn't do him any good. We saw that with Nishikori, who capitulated completely to Nadal yesterday. So yeah, and also, just let's keep a little eye out for Khachanov, who has been doing his thing nice and quietly, and lo and behold, is in a slam quarterfinal. I believe for the first time, which I find really, I'm a bit shocked. I thought he'd made quarterfinals before.
Well, Roz, wonderful tips. Lovely to speak to you as ever. Stay in the bar, keep yourself safe from the rain, and we look forward to checking in with you again very soon. Roz Sattar there, who is Love Sport's very own tennis correspondent. Of course, some of the action in France mired and indeed just straightforwardly stopped from happening today by the downpour, but we have had grass court action over in Surbiton.
Woo! Guess in. Yes, I've been over in Surbiton today, actually. Took one look at that Paris forecast and thought there's no play today.
I'm not getting on the plane.
So, yeah, exactly. You know, why? So, I mean, if there's quality tennis going on in Surbiton, which there was, I thought, why not go and check it out? I've never been to Surbiton. I know, Anna, you've been at Surbiton before. What do you make of the place?
I've played there quite a few times from back in my singles days. Yeah, I really like it. I think the atmosphere is amazing. I think it's so nice to be able to kind of come back home and have that home support. And obviously grass is my favourite time of the season, so I'm a little bit biased. But I think it's a great tournament, and it's grown so much over the years. You know, they have a massive centre court. Like you said, the people they get to play is incredible. Mm-hmm. So I think it's great for the public to get to see these guys up close. And I'm excited about the grass season.
Yeah, aren't we all? I mean, I was very impressed from what I saw. A lovely venue, well set up, and the stacked draws. It's an ATP Challenger event for the men and a W100 event, sorry, for the women. But you've got some really big names there. I mean, Nick Kyrgios is there to play doubles, Leighton Hewitt as well, who can't quite decide whether or not he's retired, but he's coming and going.
Who does that sound like?
Well, I mean, I was thinking as I said it, you know, but, you know, on the women's side as well, I was watching Vitalia Dyatchenko earlier. She was playing Serena Williams' first round of the French Open. And I've got to say, with these stacked draws in Surbiton, does this indicate that the grass court season, and I know you're biased because you love the grass, does it indicate that the season should be longer? Because there's so many people trying to get that extra time on grass courts if they don't do well at the French.
I would love the grass court season to be longer. I know kind of scheduling maybe doesn't allow it with the French Open and, you know, pushing maybe the French Open forward. So I don't know if that would ever work. Mm. But I think for me personally, the grass court season, sorry, is too short. And it ends up being quite packed in together. And then by the time you get to Wimbledon, I think everyone's quite fatigued. But I don't know how they could do it with scheduling. It'd probably be quite tricky.
Well, pushing the French Open forward, I guess, is an option. I mean, Wimbledon obviously was moved around a bit in recent years to accommodate for an extra week. I mean, the grass court season was even shorter previously. And as far as it goes with weather at the French Open, well, they can't really be doing much worse, can they? So
that's not their fault.
Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, if we were to push it forward another week, then give grass courts that bit more room. I mean, Johanna Konta has committed to playing the three lead-up events to Wimbledon. She's in the second week of the French Open. Maybe didn't expect that at the beginning of the clay court season. But if she's to go to the second week of Wimbledon, she will now have played, I think, 7 or 8 straight weeks of tournaments, which is a lot of stress on the body.
Is fatigue a concern there?
I mean, I haven't thought really that far ahead to Wimbledon because the French is still going. She's still got chances. But I was just thinking about it earlier, and because it's grass courts and there are few opportunities, she's not going to want to pull out of a tournament. It might be the best thing for her to maybe, I don't know, skip Nottingham and give herself a bit of rest, which we don't want to see her pulling out of Nottingham, of course. She's a star name and she always brings so much to the event. But, you know, I think that if she feels the pressure to kind of make herself play these events, that maybe it might crop up at Wimbledon an issue or something. What do you think?
I think, obviously, you know, maybe she's had a longer French Open than she potentially anticipated. Honestly, I'd be surprised maybe if she does play Nottingham next week, especially, you know, with it starting on Monday. I don't know if the transition from worst case scenario, her losing in the semis, to having maybe one day's prep on the grass is necessarily the best scheduling for her. I think she's got to look at the bigger picture. She wants to peak for Wimbledon. So, you know, I'd say there's a 50-50 chance of her turning up next week. And I think, you know, if she goes and wins French Open, I don't think she's going to really have too many issues about playing Nottingham next week.
Well, there is, of course, a 100% chance of Serena Williams turning up for her press conferences, and there seems to be a 25% chance of her turning up early. Coming up, it's time for Down the Line, our hard-hitting debate segment. Does Serena Williams have a bad personality? Dominic Thiem is not a happy man.
This is Love Sport.
I think we were all expecting the battles to take place on the court at the French Open rather than in the press room, but we've had a bit of falling out behind the scenes as well. Dominic Thiem says that Serena Williams showed a bad personality after he was told to end a French Open news conference to make way for her. This is a very complex one. Various people are reporting this in different ways. The suggestion from Thiem is certainly that Serena basically kicked him out because she decided she was more important. Is it that straightforward?
I don't think any of this is straightforward, let's be honest. And Anna made the comment before, a bit of a mountain out of a molehill. When people roll with this kind of story, it does get so big. But the thing for Thiem here is, totally unsuspecting, in his press conference, win his match, someone comes in and tells him to get out, and he's earned his right to be there and finish that press conference, and he's getting told he needs to move for another player. Of course he's going to be angry. Of course he's going to be frustrated, and he has a right to defend himself. But the thing with him calling, saying that Serena has a bad personality, I'm not sure where that occurred on the timescale. There's been a lot of stuff that's come out since then of, was it the organisers? I mean, obviously they made the final move, but was it more a push from them or more a push from Serena? And probably this team didn't know the full details. And I mean, if he's getting kicked out of his press conference because Serena's coming, the natural thing is to assume that Serena's behind the thing. I'm not sure I'd go as far out there as to say that she has a bad personality or things like that. But I mean, I can understand his frustration. I mean, Anna, what do you make of the whole scenario?
I think it's, does anyone actually know the real story about what happened, or if we got like 12 different version of events here?
That's,
I think, some people are going to say it was Serena, some people say it's the organizers. I think if Serena's the one who kind of pushed for it and was like, get him out, then I don't think that's great from her. But at the same time, you know, I think it is probably a bit of a mountain out of a molehill. I don't think it's great that she's kicking people out of a press conference purely because she didn't fancy waiting for an extra 5 minutes.
John McEnroe has come out in her defence, and he's saying that that isn't what was going on. He's saying that Serena asked for a smaller press room than she had previously been planned to have just so she could get it out of the way. Apparently a smaller room was available because that's where Thiem ended up. This is the words of McEnroe. When Serena was made aware that they had had to move the Austrian to make room for her, she was heard saying, "Wow, that's rude." So he's suggesting it wasn't Serena's fault. As you point out, Anna, it's very hard for us to know whether there was pressure from her on the organisers. But is she hard work? We saw a lot of controversy with the Osaka situation a few months ago. There does seem to be a suggestion, certainly from certain aspects of the media, that Williams isn't perhaps a particularly welcoming personality.
Well, I just want to say, first of all, I'm impressed to know that John McEnroe was behind the scenes and saw all that going on and was able to speak with such clarity. So cheers, John. But no, with Serena, I mean, all I can say, I mean, Anna's probably met Serena. Serena was my favourite player growing up. I loved her. I got into tennis because I was watching Serena and Venus Williams. I have so much respect for Serena. I can't stress that enough. But when she gets emotional, she gets emotional, and she doesn't take loss as well. I remember her saying a few years ago, I hate losing more than anyone else in the world. And when you've lost a big match like that on a big stage, you just want to get out.
Do you think she was sulking?
I wouldn't say sulking. I think that she just wanted to get out there, get out of there as quickly as she could and do whatever she could to make that happen. I mean, I don't think she's particularly thinking of kicking people out of press conferences, but I don't think she's gonna, I don't think she's gonna lose sleep over it at the end of the day. She had a bad loss, she wasn't happy, and she just wanted to leave that site and move on. And going back to your question, does that make her hard work? Well, yeah, because therefore, I think even if she didn't say to kick team out of his press conference, but she probably put the pressure on to, because she didn't want to wait. She made it clear she didn't want to wait. And I'm pretty convinced of that because I've seen it happen with other top players who've had bad losses. Novak Djokovic last year, when he got upset at the French Open, walked off court, walked straight into a smaller interview room, sat down for his press, and they didn't have any option there. The journalists just had to pile in. So given that it's happened before, I wouldn't be surprised if she'd put enormous pressure, whether unwittingly or unwittingly, on those organisers to make that decision.
And if the organisers then are either caving to her demands or doing it without any demands at all, do you think tennis is treating certain players as if they are bigger than the sport?
I think this is a tough one because you have to think about how much Serena has done for the women's game and women's sport in general, and the same with, you know, Roger, Rafa, Novak, Andy, and how much they bring to the sport. I think it should be equal. I don't think anyone should get preferential treatment, but it is one of those sort of grey areas where you do look at what they do bring to the sport and you kind of understand why they are given preferential treatment. But that doesn't mean I think it's right.
Do you think they are given preferential treatment?
I probably would say they do. I mean, you just have to look at the Australian Open final a couple of years ago, I think, with Marin Cilic. He asked for the roof to be closed and it got closed. I don't think Cilic was that happy about it. He wanted it played outside. So I think you have to look at that and say, in a Grand Slam final, Rog is getting what he wants. And again, I don't think that should be allowed. But yeah, like I said, what they bring to the sport and how much or how many fans and how popular they are, I think it makes it hard to go against them.
Yeah, I think they're well within their rights to. I mean, because there's always been these discussions about Federer and the schedules he gets. Like, for example, in the Australian Open, a lot of people are saying, oh, he's getting a lot of evening matches, so he doesn't have to contend with the fierce heat. And there have been times when Federer has requested that. Well, he's within his rights to request. You know, if you don't ask, you don't get.
Does everybody request? Or do you have to get to a certain point of gravitas before you even start asking?
Yeah. No, you can request. I mean, I've had occasions where I've played one week and I've played a tournament and, you know, played up until the Saturday and the tournament starts on Monday, so I request as late start as possible. But you don't always get it.
How often do they listen to you?
It depends normally if the referee likes you. So if you know the referee quite well, then sometimes they're a bit more helpful.
Whereas if you've sworn at them last week,
yeah, that's probably less likely. But no, it does very much depend. But I think you also have to be strong as a tournament referee to say no. You know, they're ultimately the ones who are arranging the tournament, arranging the schedule. So if someone comes up and says, I just want to play night matches, it is their prerogative to say no. So they don't have to agree with them. So exactly. I think the officials need to maybe take a tougher stance on it and actually say, no, we're deciding the tournament. You don't get to pick when you play, what conditions you play in. I don't think that's fair.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much on the organisers. And I think, there are occasions, I feel, where, you know, players have done a lot in the sport, or maybe they're playing at home, and obviously you're going to try and give them a bit of what they want. For example, I know Andy Murray is asked to start on certain days at the ATP finals and got his way. That's not really affecting anyone else. So fair enough, you know, if he asks that, if people oblige because he's Andy Murray, it's not really affecting anyone else. Whereas I remember talking to a player earlier this year, actually, won't name them. They will not know that I was going to come out with this, so won't name them.
I'm very curious as to who it is now.
I might let you know later. But she was talking to me about playing at a WTA event in Auckland either last year or the year before, whenever Serena was last there. But all the players had booked practice courts for certain times, certain places. Serena rocked up a bit later, said she wanted a certain court at a certain time. I think 8-10 different players had their schedules moved just to accommodate Serena's requirement for a specific time in a specific court. So, and that obviously that affects their preparation. They have to reschedule their days, as it were. And maybe it's a small thing, but it's just one of those things where actually the decision to put Serena Williams above all else actually does have an impact on someone else. Whereas with Andy Murray, you know, you're going to play on one of 2 days at the ATP Finals. That's probably not going to make too much difference which of those days it is. So,
but then you have to take into account, not in Grand Slams, obviously, and not the ATP Finals, but at the other tournaments, sort of like the women's 250s, for example, they get paid to turn up. Certain players get paid. So obviously they're going to get preferential treatment. So if Serena comes up, she's getting an appearance fee. So they're obviously going to do whatever they can to accommodate her, as opposed to someone who's in qualifying or last in a main draw. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at it from kind of the tournament organizer's perspective as well. They want to keep those top players happy, so they keep coming back.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a double-edged sword to try and keep everyone happy.
Which is an incredibly fair point, but I think it just brings us back to the question, do top players get preferential treatment? Whether people like it or not, clearly they do, because there are these pressures. There's the pressure of the player themselves. There's the pressure of having paid a fee or something for the player to be there and therefore needing to please them. There are so many different factors that does make this a thing, and in some cases makes it an issue. So definitely something to be wary of, I think.
But in these minor instances of preferential treatment, even from just a cynical perspective, shouldn't these big stars be a bit more aware of their PR? Because from Williams' point of view, whether or not she did this, it's a really bad look. The fact that we're having this conversation, the media generally are having this conversation, doesn't do her any favours in terms of image. Should they not just be a little more careful, a little more perhaps humble?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. But at the same time, I think she's got so many fans worldwide that they'd probably overlook it as well.
She'd do what
I think
she likes.
Yeah, basically. I think she's probably done a lot worse than just, well, you look at the US Open, I think semi-final with the line judge and whatever. So I think she has done a lot worse. I think this is, to be honest, I do think it's a bit of a non-story. Yeah. I think it's a bit dramatic. You know, I don't think, unless someone has categorically heard her say, get team out of the room, then I think it's a bit unfair to say she's got a bad personality and everything. So
yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing with this situation, I mean, the situation in and of itself has been blown out of proportion. Federer was saying he found it a bit of a laugh. I think some people probably did. But the thing I find with Serena at the moment is she's becoming very much a celebrity figure. She's outside of tennis. So when something happens, there's a legion of people that support Serena Williams, the person, not necessarily Serena Williams, the player. And she does no wrong. She is this perfect, God-sent human being that just doesn't mess up, you know? And that has an impact on these kind of situations as well, because Dominic Thiem then is therefore made to feel like he's done something wrong. So, I mean, it's a bit of a mess, really, isn't it? You know, there's so many different angles to it.
Well, coming up, we're going to move into a different, smaller studio. Producer Charlie, just go and check ahead. If there's anyone in there, I don't care, move them.
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to The Tennis Show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, Abigail Johnson and Anna Smith. And the big question is, have there been any major, major shocks, any shocks at all in the French Open so far?
Well, with tennis, I'm always very careful to try not to be shocked, because especially I feel like in the women's draws, it's so open at the moment, you're generally not very surprised when people go out. However, and there's a big however, at the beginning of the tournament, we were forced to make predictions. And two of my leading contenders were top seed Naomi Osaka, 23-time Grand Slam champion Serena Williams, both out in round three. And honestly, I consider them surprises, given who they were up against. I mean, if Osaka was going out, I saw it being against a bigger name than Katerina Siniakova, who's doubles number one, got a lot of variety in her game. She's really good to watch. But with Osaka, I've noticed the players she struggles with are players that aren't top 10 at the moment, but maybe have been in the past or have the standard of a top 10 player, just not the status. And she tends to feel the pressure against those players and sometimes goes to pieces a bit. I mean, we saw her struggling against Donna Vekic recently. Victoria Azarenka, I thought, would be the difficult one for Osaka. And once she negotiated that, I thought, oh, she might be in this for the long haul. Went out next round. So for me, I'm going to be honest with you. Straight sets lost for Osaka in the third round was a bit surprising to me. Serena, maybe not so much because of the lack of match play she had coming into the tournament. But still, you know, going out early at a slam, it's not something we often see.
Let's start on top seed Osaka. Anna, as far as you're concerned, was that a shock?
Probably not. I think I'd have been more shocked if it had been a hard court or on a grass court. I didn't have her picked down to win the title. I thought she could do well, but I thought maybe she'd slip up against more of a sort of clay court specialist. But for me, I don't think it was a shock. And again, Serena going out, I didn't think that was much of a shock either because, you know, she hasn't played much. And clay's obviously her least favourite surface. So that wasn't a shock for me. Obviously, I thought my predictions were Kiki Bertens and Pliskova, and then I did call Halep as well. So I'm holding on to Halep and really hoping that she makes final and then Joe beats her in the final. Yeah. But you know, I think the way women's tennis is nowadays, I don't feel like there's such a clear favourite for any tournament.
Absolutely.
And I think anyone can win, and it shows that most of the slams pretty much it's never been the favourite who's gone on to win. So I don't think there have that been, or especially in the women's side, I don't think there have been that many shocks for me anyway.
Yeah, I stand by the no shocks on the women's circuit thing, really. But I mean, if we're going to the closest thing to a shock, I mean, my thing with Osaka is that she gets up for the big events. She'd won the last two Grand Slams. Indian Wells was her first ever title on the pro circuit. And she's got such a big game. She is, and I hate making comparisons between players because they are an individual in their own right. But at times I feel like I'm watching a mini Serena Williams. When she's getting the first serve in, when she's dictating from the baseline, moving into the court, you genuinely feel that it's on her racket. And it's for that reason that I didn't take surface really into consideration. I just thought, this is a major. This is Naomi Osaka who gets up for these moments, and therefore I think she will do well. And that's why, for me, that came close to a surprise.
And she's still so young, only 21. How far can she go in the game?
Oh, very far. I think the way she plays, the game she has, she can take the game away from anyone. I think that's the difference between, you know, some of the other top girls, like Halep, for example. She has to fight for every point, whereas Osaka can get 3 points off the serve, off the forehand, off the backhand. She has so many weapons in comparison to some of the other girls that I think it makes her more of a force than necessarily some of the other ones who have to work a lot harder. And I think she can be as good as she wants to be. I think more for her, it's kind of controlling those emotions. Because as we've all seen, you know, I think in her first round match, she was crying under the towel. So, you know, if she can control those emotions a little bit better, as we've seen in the Australian Open final, US, that she plays her best on the big occasions and she handles those occasions well. So if she can kind of just get that more under control, she can win a lot more majors for me.
I sometimes have a cry under a towel in ad break. it actually really helps. So don't knock it till you try it.
I think I might have to give it a go now.
No, I think Osaka is well on her way, and that Australian Open title for me was a massive statement because we've seen many first-time winners on the WTA over the past few years. We saw Yelena Ostapenko win the French Open when she just turned 20. And to be fair, like Ostapenko, she made that Wimbledon semi-final run last year, but she's not won a match at the French Open since. Osaka wins her first major title under controversial circumstances in the end, and people were worried about how she'd cope with it mentally, emotionally. Comes out and looks like an absolute force on her way to the title in Melbourne. Petra Kvitova did not play badly in that final. It was massive hitting, and it just came down to the fact that in that final set, Osaka was the more steady and the more consistent player, and the maturity that she's able to display in some of her matches, and then her awareness of when she doesn't. So in the lead up to the Australian Open, she really let her emotions get the better of herself. She got frustrated, she got down on herself, and she was open about that. She spoke to people about it. She said, this is something I need to improve. And that self-awareness combined with the maturity to rise up against the biggest players in the biggest moments, I think is what really stands out about Osaka. And I'm not putting a lid on how many majors, you know, she's so young, has two. And, you know, Angelique Kerber got her two when she was well on. So who knows with Osaka how far she could go. Who do you think her biggest challenges are in terms of that younger group?
Oh, God, I think there's quite a few coming up. Anna Samova, obviously, I think she's got a lot of potential. God, I don't know. That's the thing with women's tennis. It's, you know, you can have one good week and then, you know, a few terrible weeks and then someone else comes up. And I think it's really hard to pick. I wouldn't like to say anyone. I don't know. I kind of see Osaka dominating for a little bit. I think she's got the potential, the game. And also what impressed me the most in that Australian Open final, she had match points in that second set. She could have easily buckled under that. But the way she regrouped and came back to win that third set, especially the way Petra was playing, was she wasn't playing badly at all. But the way she managed to regroup and get her emotions back, I thought I was so impressed with that.
100%. You've got to have that mental and physical package, haven't you? It's got to come hand in hand. That's the thing.
And talking about dominance, we are underway in the first of our UEFA Nations League semi-finals. It's Portugal versus Switzerland, and it has been all Switzerland so far. They could have had a couple, but of course Portugal with a dangerous little front two in that 4-4-2. The ageing star Cristiano Ronaldo, partnered by the wonder kid in João Félix, always going to be a threat. But turning our attentions back to tennis, what do we have to look forward to this week?
This week in Paris or this week in Surbiton?
Both.
Well, I mean, biggest thing to look forward to at the French Open, in something that we know for sure is going to happen. Roger Federer versus Rafael Nadal. The thing is, in the past, I think, on clay, people would have sat back and thought, yeah, it's Federer versus Nadal, but hello, it's Nadal on clay and he's rocking it and he will dominate. But, you know, Federer's won their last five meetings, and yeah, they haven't come on clay, but there's got to be that mental aspect that means that Nadal is really taking him as a serious threat. What would you say?
Yeah, I don't think you can ever discount probably the greatest player to ever play the game as not a threat. But at the same time, I think this year, like we said last week, that Federer is kind of a bit more of an underdog this week. You know, he has no pressure on him as he maybe has in previous years. So I think that might work in his favour. He can maybe go in a little bit more relaxed. You know, Rafa wants to win this French Open. It's his title. Mm. So I think that, you know, if Rog can relax a little bit, I think that first set will be crucial. If Rog can put that pressure on and win that first set, I think maybe Rafa will get a little bit more nervous, you know, start to maybe defend a little bit more, and that gives Rog a chance to attack a lot. But I don't know. I you'd have to say Rafa's the favourite for sure.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that I think one of the biggest keys in this matchup might be what has essentially created the Federer backhand, the Nadal forehand to the Federer backhand in these conditions with it so high bouncing. That's got to be lethal against Federer's one-hander. I mean, Nadal's going to be playing in his favourite conditions on his favourite court, Philippe Chatrier, and he's going to have five sets to play with. Now, maybe we'd be looking at a different scenario if it was a three-set match. But, you know, over best of five, even if it goes long, surely Nadal's going to dig within himself and find the stuff to bring it out. How much of an impact do you think nerves might have when it comes to Nadal?
I think with Rafa, it might have a bit of an impact. I also think conditions massively will help. I think if it's hot and it's very dry and it's going to kick up a lot, I think that's going to favour Rafa the most. But then I don't know what the weather forecast is meant to be for Friday. I think if it's damp, heavy conditions, then I think that's going to favour Roger a little bit more, because that backhand's going to be taken a little bit lower, more at waist height.
Sure.
So I think a lot of it will depend on conditions, and I think it's going to depend a lot on how aggressive Roger wants to be, because in these previous matches, he's been very aggressive, looking to use the forehand a lot, serve and volley a little bit, and I think that's what he's going to have to do to try and have a chance against Rafa.
Yeah, short points are a massive thing, I think. And for Federer, you know, in that win over Wawrinka, he won in four sets, but so many wasted break points, you know. And I think that he's going to want to end those points quickly to stop that Nadal drawing it out and putting himself in a winning position.
Well, you mentioned that you were both put on the spot before the first episode of this. You were forced to make predictions. If you had to make calls in that particular matchup, who are you going for?
Rafa in four.
Oh, she's going for sets as well. Great.
I went big.
Yeah, here's the thing. I mean, I picked Nadal to win the event before it started, so I have to stick with him. I do think over best of five, he'll find it within himself. And am I allowed to copy? I wouldn't call it copying, but
you can't copy.
I need at least a difference of a set or two.
Oh, wonderful, because I'd have gone Nadal in four, but would it go five, though? I'm not sure it would.
But you're confident, both of you, that it'll be Nadal.
Yeah.
We're, of course, confident it's going to be a fantastic week of tennis in both France and Surbiton. And you'll have to join us next week to look back on it here at the Tennis Show on Love Sport Radio.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.